Welcome to Global Journalist on KBIA. This is the program that says mid-Missourians, indeed many Americans, are interested in international news. I'm Stuart Lurie of the Missouri School of Journalism. It went by with little notice, but for 20 days, there were no suicide attacks or bombings in the Middle East, kindling the feeling that Israel was making headway in its efforts to bring security to the country, and that perhaps there was some hope of new settlement talks after all. Then, as a meeting was about to begin in New York of organizations and countries seeking a settlement, the killings started again. Near a West Bank Jewish settlement, and yesterday in downtown Tel Aviv. Hopes for progress were again dashed. Israeli restraint was severely undercut. President Bush's attempts to have a settlement devised by his administration were severely shaken. Meanwhile, there is increasing talk around the world that the United States' go-it-alone policies may run into trouble, even with our so-called British cousins. The Economist, the London-based international news magazine, ran a story recently saying there were cracks developing in the long-term alliance and that Prime Minister Tony Blair was unhappy with the way President Bush has been snubbing him. To talk about these two issues, the Middle East and British-American relations, we have in London Matthew Simons, political editor of The Economist, in Jerusalem David Horowitz, editor of The Jerusalem Report, and in Washington Howard LaFranchi, the foreign affairs reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, and Martin Schramm, a syndicated columnist for the Scripps Howard News Service. Let's start with the Middle East. David Horowitz, maybe you can bring us up to date on what has happened in the last several hours and whether or not Israeli retaliation will take place, or will the Israeli government continue to show some restraint?
Well, what's happened in the last couple of days, as you rightly say, has been this restart of shootings and bombings. But there was no sense in Israel, although there was that relative respite of about 3 weeks, there was no sense in Israel that the bombings were over or anything like that, because almost every day there were actually interceptions of would-be bombers and discoveries of car bombs and all sorts of incidents such as that. So really the sense out here was that it was merely a matter of time before one or more attackers managed to succeed, and a very grim resignation that has now in fact taken place. In terms of retaliation, the Israeli army is very, very widely deployed inside the West Bank. It is not deployed in every, by definition, it could not possibly be deployed in every Palestinian village, but it is heavily deployed in almost all of the major population centers. It's hard to conceive of what the government might order the army to do that it is not doing, and instead what the government is really doing is really reiterating the messages that it thinks America has understood and that Europe largely has not, which is that a firm position needs to be taken here against a Palestinian leadership that, far from attempting to thwart the bombings, is funding and inciting them. And really, it's at the policy level, I think, that the Israeli response is going to be felt. These bombings are seen as confirmation of a line that George Bush has understood and that Europe seems unwilling to understand.
Let's go to Washington. Howard LaFranchi, what do you think of what David just said, and how is the Bush administration reacting to all this?
Well, I think what we should be watching is that today three Arab foreign ministers will be meeting with President Bush, the foreign ministers of Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, and they will be trying to convince President Bush that the continued violence supports their position, that there needs to be movement ahead on all fronts, not just on security, but on moving ahead on political issues and economic humanitarian issues as well. I was just at a meeting this morning with the Egyptian foreign minister, and he said that, speaking of this idea that there had been 20 days or whatever of calm, he said, well, you know, now we're starting to hear that, well, we're really going to need 7 weeks of calm, and as some people are starting to wonder, when does that become 7 years and then maybe 7 centuries? So obviously the Arab leaders are not not only not won over by the idea of the supremacy of security, but they're going to try to convince President Bush today that he needs to give consideration to some of these other components for moving towards some kind of peace.
Are they going to try to convince President Bush that he cannot continue to advocate the dumping of Yasser Arafat?
Well, I think basically what they're going to try to do, I mean, the president has spoken, and so I think they see it as unrealistic and futile to try to change the president's mind. I don't think they think they can accomplish that, so I think what they're looking for is maybe to try to work around that, as Arab diplomats behind doors will always say, you know, none of us loves Yasser Arafat, but so we have to find another way to work around him. And there are reports that they will be taking this idea of creating a Palestinian or moving towards elections soon, with that would create a new parliament and create a prime minister, and perhaps making Yasser Arafat a little more than a figurehead president.
It's Marty Schramm.
Yes, Marty.
I was just going to note that that it's my understanding that what the Arab foreign ministers plan to do is to give Bush a plan that was adopted in Cairo the end of last week, and that plan says that, yes, there should be elections, but that it's also contingent on on Israel's military withdrawing from the West Bank, from the occupied areas. And that being the case, the real question is Bush prepared to make demands of both sides? And so far, he really hasn't.
Yeah, that clearly, in the Egyptian foreign minister this morning was clearly putting an emphasis on making demands on both sides, as he said, bridging the gap between what he saw as front-loading demands on the Palestinians and back-loading demands on the Israelis, but in bridging that gap and bringing them together, because he too spoke of an Egypt that's willing to work with the Palestinians, for example, on reforming their security forces, but he said, you know, that's not possible to do in an occupied territory, an occupied country.
Exactly what I thought, David.
Yeah, Matthew Simons, what is the feeling in the United Kingdom now about how this is being handled by countries that are involved but not directly involved, like the European Union, like Russia, like the United States, and like the United Nations?
Well, I think, as usual in a way, Britain kind of occupies a position slightly between that of the U.S. and the European Union. I mean, I think that the European Union is engaged clearly in a very different way from that of the U.S. It is a major funder of the Palestinian Authority, and it believes that the contacts that it has with the Palestinians are ones which can be usefully leveraged, and it should continue to play that as a role. And certainly, I think, you know, we in the UK would tend to go along with that. Where I think there is a difference between Britain and the rest of Europe, as I see it, is that I think our government is pretty much as disenchanted with Yasser Arafat as Mr. Bush is. When I have spoken to people at 10 Downing Street, their view is that this really is no longer a guy who you can usefully do business with. Whereas I think there is a very sort of strong attachment to the idea in Europe that Arafat still is in some sense an integral part of any peace process. So that's, I think, a big gap.
Yeah, it seems to me that here in the United States, the president has a political problem if he tries to be too even-handed. It is not only the so-called Israeli lobby or the Jewish lobby in this country that is now pro-Israel, but it is the general Christian right, if you will, that has aligned itself with the Israeli cause, and that is going to create problems for Bush in being even-handed, even if he wanted to be. Marty, what do you think?
Stuart, I think that's a very good point. The so-called Jewish lobby has always been cited by so many Middle East watchers as being so powerful in the United States, but it really was not able to significantly move Republican presidents and administrations anywhere near as powerfully as the Christian coalition can. Conservative Republicans that are part of the backbone of the Republican Party. The interesting thing is, I think Bush has kind of gotten himself out on a limb by being so uneven in his original policy. And I think that he's going to find it hard to get back to what he needs to do if he's going to really be the broker that achieves a peace there, which is to say that by putting all his demands on the Palestinians initially and on their Arab benefactors to the extent that they have them, this makes life very difficult for him, because in the end, there does have to be a certain reciprocity, which is to say that Israel knows that it's eventually going to have to turn over those West Bank areas. And so without being able to specify what's going to happen to settlements and what's going to happen in the West Bank, they wind up in a very tough situation of just pushing for elections. And what if Yasser Arafat wins the elections popularly? Does America, the great democracy, say we don't trust those elections?
I think there's a short-term concern here on the part of the administration that the U.S. is coming up to a campaign period, and I think a number of the partners in the peace process understand that, and that's one of the reasons there's not going to be or there is going to be an effort to work around, in a sense, work around the president's stated position at this time, realizing that for the next few months they're not going to get him to budge. But more longer term, I think what Marty says is right, and if you look at everyone points to polls of Americans that show greater support for Israel, and that's true, but there are also polls that show that a very deep desire for an even-handed approach to the problem and a recognition that that's the only way it's going to be solved. There's more of a visceral attachment to Israel on the part of many Americans, but when you ask questions about how to solve the conflict, there's also a very widespread support for an even-handed approach by the United States, and in fact recognition that that's necessary.
And Howard, let me just add, this is Marty, that among black Americans, Afro-Americans in polls, there's increasingly a dissatisfaction with Israel and a linking with Palestinians being downtrodden, victimized, whatever the reasons. And that means that the backbone of the Democratic Party also is undergoing a bit of a shift. So politics is changing in America as it regards the Middle East.
I wanted to ask my colleagues in America a question. One of our people in Washington, D.C. was at the White House recently, and he said to me when he returned from that visit that he got the feeling that the dislike within the White House of the Palestinians had become absolutely visceral, that, you know, that this went beyond a sort of, you know, a disapproval of certain courses of action. It went beyond a desire to kind of isolate diplomatically for a period, but it was actually something pretty close to sort of loathing. Is that something which they pick up on?
Who wants to take that, Marty?
Oh, sure. Yes, I would say. I would put it in with different words, but the bottom line is the same. I would say that that George Bush and his advisors feel that Yasser Arafat lied to him, flat out lied to him time and again, and it's reached a point that they don't believe anything he says. They don't believe he'll do anything he says he's going to do. Therefore, it makes it hard for them to find a way.
I absolutely see that as far as Arafat is concerned, and I think we would feel the same way about him in London,
but
he's also lied to us on numerous occasions. But I think going further than that, that actually sort of, you know, not just Arafat, but much of what we think of as the Palestinians themselves.
Well, they've had the real problem I have with the Bush's policy is that they failed to look beyond Arafat to find elements that they should be working with to try to achieve their goals. That's Bush's failure.
Okay, fellas, we have to take a break right now. This is Global Journalist on KBIA. I'm Stuart Lurie, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Global Journalist. You may listen to this program again, ask questions, or make comments by going to www.globaljournalist.org or here in Mid-Missouri by calling us at 573-882-9641. We have been talking about the Middle East, and I would like to continue that for just a little bit before we move to the other subject. David Horowitz, you heard our guests from Washington, Marty Schramm and Howard LaFranchi, talk about an even-handed approach and say that any settlement is going to have to involve the removal of settlements from the West Bank. Do the Israelis understand that, and will they ultimately agree to that point?
I think, I mean, the discussion so far is very interesting, and I just before I answer you specifically, to come in on some of the other points that were made, I think the Bush administration, from where the Israeli government sits, is trying to be very even-handed. The understanding from here is that there were many drafts of this Bush speech, and all the things that are demanded of Israel, including the compromises that you've just talked about, are still in the speech. But as it went through the various drafts, what seems to have happened is that Bush didn't really just redraft this on the basis of Arafat merely lying to him, but on the basis of Arafat actually being, as he put it, contaminated by complicit in terrorism. Bush has come to the conclusion that all the demands that he needs to make of Israel will absolutely need to be made, but they cannot be made of an Israel that is asked to negotiate with a leadership that is complicit in terrorism, and therefore he redrafts this speech, really, to demand that the Palestinian public realize that their interests can only be served by the ousting of Yasser Arafat and the rest of his leadership. And then all the demands that he has put to Israel and that were contained in that speech will become operative. I think that that's a very, very important point. And Israelis, you see, would say, Israelis across the spectrum would say, in terms of the compromises that they may be asked to make further down the road, they will say they don't know what this government would be prepared to do when push came to shove, if push came to shove. But they would argue that in 1999, when they elected Ehud Barak, they ousted the right-wing Benjamin Netanyahu, and they elected Barak. And that vote, that 56-44% election of Barak, was effectively a majority support for heavy compromise. So they would say, yes, they're ready to make the compromises. They can't do it with this Palestinian leadership. They're delighted that President Bush has done the same thing. And in terms of Bush's failure in finding an alternative Palestinian leadership, most Israelis would have a great deal of sympathy with President Bush because they don't see much sign of an alternative Palestinian leadership out there to be cultivated.
Okay, thank you for that, David. I would like to change the subject right now. Recently, there was an article in The Economist, written, I understand, by Matthew Simons, headlined, "Listen, George, Tony Blair has staked a lot on his relationship with George Bush. That makes recent snubs particularly damaging to Mr. Blair." Matthew, what is the situation? Is there a serious rift growing between the United States and the United Kingdom?
No, I don't think that there is, actually, which sort of may sound an odd answer after what you read out from the piece that I wrote. What I was talking about more was the way Blair himself, the way his relationship is perceived by particularly critics within his own party as being too willing to do whatever George Bush's bidding is, while at the same time it doesn't seem to be a relationship in which there's any sort of reciprocity. There's been really quite a lot of anger here about some aspects of American policy which has kind of impacted on UK interests, the steel tariffs, the farm bill, both of which were seen as being a highly protectionist, then also a considerable amount of concern about the US stance on the International Criminal Court. But I think particularly though the issue of protectionism over steel has really kind of upset people in the sense that they feel that despite the really kind of strong support that has been shown for the US, that we suddenly find ourselves being hammered something which, you know, we were in no sense to blame for, and we were looking for a little bit of sort of slack, I think, from the Americans on that, and Blair talked to Bush at the G8 summit about that and got really absolutely nothing at all. So I think, you know, that may sound like quite a sort of a narrow issue, but it certainly played quite strongly here. But overall, I think one has to understand that Blair is not going to change in any sense his policy towards his relationship with Bush. He would regard very near the sort of the top of his priorities, if he was writing out his job description, he would put near the top having a constructive and close relationship with the American president. And he will go on working on that come what may. The other thing to say, I think, is that the support that our government has given to the US government over the war on terror is not seen by it as simply supporting America. It is seen absolutely as doing something which is wholly in our interests as well. So from that point of view, you know, we pursue that policy no matter what.
Howard LaFranchi, is the Bush administration attuned to the criticism that it is getting from around the world about its go-it-alone policies, and what is it doing to, if anything, to try to counteract that feeling?
Well, I would say it's attuned. If you look at the State Department, I think Secretary of State Colin Powell is attuned to that and wants to discourage that kind of go-it-alone tendency by the United States for long-term interests. I mean, he understands that, say, in the case of Iraq, for example, if the United States does move against Iraq, it won't be able to do that alone. And so you can't disregard your friends along the way and then expect them to be with you. But within the White House itself, some of Bush's top advisors there, and then the defense secretary Donald Rumsfeld, I think there's a different thinking that that the United States is a unique power in the world. It should be able to move as it pretty much as it sees. The allies and partners are important, but they have to understand this special role of the United States and not be constantly pushing things like the International Criminal Court that they see do limit the United States' sovereignty.
Marty Schramm, I don't get the feeling that anybody in this country of great importance is really concerned about this aspect of American policy. Am I overstating that?
Only in one sense, Stuart. You're overstating it because as Howard pointed out, over at the State Department, Colin Powell and his clique understand. The problem is not that the State Department is in tune with these concerns, but the State Department is not in tune with its own White House or anyone else. Every item in the list that Matthew has in his piece, which I enjoyed reading, by the way, is a matter that Colin Powell had very, very little, if any, say over. The farm bill, the steel, no. Kyoto, he didn't do very well with that either. The criminal court, most recently, all those things were matters where he was not very influential. The only thing I would say is while that piece in the Economist talked about personal chemistry and how important it is. This isn't a matter of chemistry; it's a matter of physics. It's all those policies that Bush was reverting to type on, and that type is not going to go over very well. I might add, by the way, that Bill Clinton had a far better, more Republican sort of policy than George Bush on matters like steel tariffs and the farm bill and so on.
Okay, fellas, I'm sorry, but we only have about a minute and 10 seconds left. And I would like to ask each of you for your prediction, if you will, on whether or not the United States is going to go to war against Iraq. Let's start with Marty.
Yes.
Howard?
Yes, but not as soon as some people are talking about. I think it will be at least early next year at the earliest.
And Matthew?
From what I hear, I think early next year sounds like a good bet. That's what we're expecting here anyway.
And David Horovitz. And David, if you could just add a phrase or two about how this would go down in Israel.
I think Israel wants the Americans to attack as soon as possible. It thinks it might well get caught up in the crossfire, that if Saddam on the way down may want to throw anything he can, he'd throw it at Israel. And I think Israel thinks that the way it's resolved, if it is a definitive and clear victory for America, that will be very good news
okay,
for peacemaking
David,
in the Middle East.
I'm sorry, I have to cut you off. We are out of time. Our guests today have been in London, Matthew Simons of The Economist, in Jerusalem, David Horovitz of The Jerusalem Report, and in Washington, Howard LaFranchi of the Christian Science Monitor and Marty Schramm of the Scripps Howard News Service. Our director is Mary Furness, our producer, Mariana DeMaio. For all, I'm Stuart Lurie. Global Journalist will be back next week.